Hello, everyone, and welcome to Queens of the Bees, your favorite queer movie and TV podcast, and ours too. I am your co-host, TJ, the ever messy, sloppy, emotionally overburdened, complete and utter basket case Pisces TJ. And this is my co-host.
And I'm Aaron.
And you are a...
I am a human being.
I think that's debatable.
I'm a professor. I'm a big gymnastics fan.
He's trying my patience is what he's doing. He's an Aries, ladies and gentlemen. And like all Aries, he's a very good fellow, I have to say. You know me, I'm a sucker for a good fire sign. He's not quite as, you know, attention-hoggy as the Leos, but nor does he have sort of the, I don't know, the life of the partiness of the Sagittarius. So he's a nice, solid, you know, stand-up guy. You can always count on an Aries to be that kind of person. So, you know, the Rams, you gotta go cheer for them, I guess. I guess we could use a sports metaphor, given that we're talking about a sports movie today. So, with that being said, Aaron, what do you want to tell our listeners what we're talking about today?
We are talking about the classic film from 1992, A League of Their Own.
We are. So we all have to write this down, ladies, gentlemen, and NBs. We're talking about a sports movie here at Queens of the Bees. This may be the first time that we have ever done a sports film in the entire almost 2 years of our existence.
Let's help our audience out, TJ. Is this the first time you've ever watched anything involving sports?
That is not true, actually. I have seen a number of sports movies. I have, among others, I've seen Angels in the Outfield, also about baseball.
Yes.
Which I think counts. I've seen bits and pieces of Field of Dreams. I've also watched, I think I've watched We Are Marshall, the sports drama about the Marshall football team, but only because I went to school at Marshall. I've seen Remember the Titans. Let's see what I know. I've seen a couple of other ones, so I have in fact watched sports ball dramas before.
Now, have you watched sports before, not in a movie?
I mean, I did go to almost every high school football game because I was in band, and so I had to. So yes, I have. I also, this is a very deep cut for my memory, but I actually, when I first went to college, I was thinking about joining a frat. I ended up going to a frat house. It wasn't even a frat house. It was some guy's apartment to watch a football game. So, that was interesting and quickly persuaded me that frat life was not for me. So anyway, we don't need
to. That's unfortunate for you.
So we don't have to, like I said, we don't have to go too far afield into my encounters with sports. So let's dive right into the movie and maybe start out by explaining why we chose A League of Their Own for this week's film. For me, at least, it was partly Mercenary, and that, you know, there is obviously the new series currently streaming on Prime Video that is, I think, a little more explicitly queer than its 1992 predecessor. It's also more, like, inclusive racially speaking. In fact, some of the reviews have pointed out it might be a little bit anachronistic in its portrayal. But it's also true, I think, that A League of Their Own, the 1992 version, has had a long and sort of rich history with queer viewers in particular.
Oh, definitely, yes.
And there's a lot of reasons for that, among them that it has both Madonna and Rosie O'Donnell in it.
Yeah. Officially makes it a queer movie right there.
Exactly.
It's just like, having even if it those had two involved.
Right, if it had no other characters at all... It would itself make it a queer film.
I think even if they weren't actually acting, if you just had them, like a little picture of them on the screen while other stuff was going on, I still think that would count.
Yes. And of course, you know, it also has Gina Davis, not Gina Gershon. I keep making that mistake when I talk about this film. So I want to be clear. I know the difference between Gina Davis and Gina Gershon. And so obviously she's sort of the main character, and she, by this point in her career, had already sort of established herself as a queer icon for having been in Thelma & Louise itself, a very queer film, although ostensibly about straight people. And in this film, she plays Dorothy Dottie Hinson, who's, you know, arguably the most important player in the team. And so that's part, all of this is part of the reason that we chose it. And it's also true that, like, the Women's Baseball League that is the center of the film, you know, which the film depicts their organization and their internal struggles as they are playing baseball during the war, is been in the news both because of obviously the new version, but also because one of the players in the original team came out at age 95. So there's a lot of queer, and she has gone on record as saying that a lot of the women who played in the league were queer. And so it just seems like a good time to look back 30 years ago at how differently we think about these issues related to women and women's sports and all that kind of thing, and sort of dig down into why this film is so popular among queer audiences and what it can tell us today.
Exactly. And again, I think that's so important because, you know, sports, not just baseball, but sports in general, have been a place where, you know, queer women in particular, you know, have been able to go and, you know, find some ways, even way back in the past, of finding camaraderie and fellowship with other folks who share that queer identity. If you just look at, you know, I'm a big Olympics fan. If you just look at sort of the lists of out queer athletes, you know, something like the Olympics, the number of women who are out in queer sports is always way higher than the number of men who are out in sports. And that's why having a movie like this, even though it, again, it doesn't explicitly come out and name anyone as queer, again, it fits into that larger paradigm of sports being a space where you could find that sort of thing.
Right. And I mean, there are, to be sure, like, moments where this comes up, like, diegetically speaking, like, where some of the characters confront the gendered expectations. Because we're talking about the 1940s. So for our listeners who may not have seen the film, it's set during the 1940s, during the war. The whole reason that these women are being recruited to play in this women's baseball league is because most of the major baseball players have gone on to war. And so in order to sort of keep American morale, that's part of the reason they formed it, was so that baseball could continue, given that, you know, traditionally baseball is America's pastime.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say that, personally speaking, baseball is one of the sports I understand the most, and I don't, like, dislike, actively dislike. So I genuinely think that baseball is a fun sport to watch. And I'm giving a shout-out to my dear friend Ben, who I know will listen to this at some point, who is a gay who likes baseball, which I find strange, but whatever. So I'm just giving him a little shout-out, because I know he's a huge baseball aficionado. So, there's a lot to enjoy about this film, so maybe we'll start with maybe the cast, and then we can use that as our gateway into the broader queer thematics. Because as I've mentioned already, you know, it has Gina Davis, who I genuinely think is a great actress. Like, I feel like, you know, she peaked in the 90s, but she is someone whose presence I always enjoy just because she seems such a nice person, and she always captures these really interesting female characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have to say, you know, the film begins with this, you know, set in the present day. And the woman they got to play, the older version of Dottie, is spot on. Like, exactly. Looks like you would imagine a 60-some-odd-year-old Gina Gershon. Or sorry, damn it, I knew that was going to happen. Gina Davis to look.
We're going to count how many times that happens.
And so, you know, the film is very much about her relationship with her younger sister, and the two have this kind of, you know, ongoing rivalry. And I enjoy that because I think that that's also one of the things that gives this film its kind of emotional heart. And mm-hmm. although, you know, the sister is played by someone we don't really know. Like, she's not someone who's had a huge career, but I like the dynamic between the siblings as the film goes on.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Lori Petty, is who plays Kit, the younger sister, you know, she's definitely a well-known actress.
Sure.
You know, I want to make sure we don't overlook her and all the great stuff that she's done. But what I love about the way her character is sort of used in the movie, sort of in the context of this sort of, you know, of us talking about this movie as a queer, as a movie for queer audiences, even though it's not explicitly queer, the way that she sort of juxtaposed against her older sister Dottie is, you know, Kit is, you know, she's the younger sister, but she's also the one who's not married and doesn't seem to be particularly dedicated to getting married or anything like that. She's happy kind of on her own and being able to play sports. She's kind of presented much more as the explicitly kind of tomboyish character, to use an old fashioned term.
Right.
You know, whereas with Dottie, she's shown as being, you know, of course, every bit as, you know, physically and athletically capable, you know, of, as Kit, actually more of a standout athlete, but she also very much does sort of do the traditional femininity in much more clear ways.
That's very true. Yes. And it's interesting then, because the film then at the end flashes forward and we see the older versions of Dottie and Kit. And it's, I mean, obviously Dottie is, you know, much more still traditionally feminine, but it's interesting that Kit also has like this huge family. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like the film had to go out. I mean, had to go out of its way to make sure we knew she was heterosexual.
Exactly. Because throughout the film, there's never really any indication of that at all. Like I said, right. Whereas Dottie and some of the other women are like already married as the story's going on.
Yes, exactly. And especially because we, you know, we get a very brief glimpse of Dottie's married life when her husband comes back, and she has this moment of like basically abandoning the league, but then returns. And it's, you know, it's just interesting, as you say, that like her story is so explicitly framed as hetero from the beginning that mm-hmm. we, you know, we get this sense that she's already bought into domestic ideology even before the war is over.
Exactly. And that's something that even, you know, comes up, you know, right at the beginning when she's asked, you know, to join the league in the first place. You know, she, you know, thinks about what her husband, you know, would say, but he's away, of course, so it doesn't matter if he would say yes or no because he's off serving in the war. But throughout the movie, considerations about what'll happen when her husband comes home and all that kind of stuff, they explicitly talk about that stuff. And every time it comes up, she says, well, when her husband comes home, she's going to go home. And spoiler alert, right, that's exactly what she ends up doing, kind of.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of, you know, the cast, like, he's played by Bill Pullman, you know, another great 90s actor. And he's only in the movie for, like, 5 minutes, maybe. But it's nice to see that he supports Dottie, that he doesn't sort of... He's not the one who makes her make this choice between the sport and her domestic duties. She makes that choice.
Yeah, exactly. And that's such an important call, because it would be easy to sort of dismiss this as sort of a, you know, once the man shows up, he sort of makes the woman go back into the home. And like you said, it's so interesting that the way it plays out in this particular story is that she has already pre-decided that she would go home the instant her husband came home, and really mm-hmm. doesn't even ask him what he would want her to do. She just says, well, let's go home.
Right. And I mean, I don't want to get too Freudian about this, because, you know, for a whole host of reasons, but it does strike me as arresting that he's injured when he comes home. Like, mm-hmm. it is, like, so if I were to push this too far, like, she is the sort of whole subject, because obviously she's the one who's, you know, extremely skilled at playing baseball, whereas he is, you know, I don't want to say, like, symbolically castrated, because, again, I don't want to take this to a Freudian level, but I do think that there is something about this film that is suggestive, at least, of the kind of gender play that it's so invested in other ways, which we'll get to in a bit. But it's mm-hmm. that's one of those moments where that's really crystallized, because it makes such a point of making her husband be injured, which mm-hmm. is such a sharp juxtaposition to her own extreme athleticism, which we've seen throughout the film.
Exactly. That's a really, really good point there.
Yeah, so like I said, I don't want to push that too far in the Freudian, but I mean, this is the early 90s, so it wouldn't be completely out of the realm of possibility. But of course, you know, this is an embarrassment of riches when it comes to just kind of like 90s aesthetics, 90s sensibility, and 90s actors, because, you know, as I said earlier, we have Madonna. Not a great actress, but I do think that this is one of her good roles, I think, just because it doesn't overuse her, and it really plays to her strengths as a performer. And also, of course, Rosie O'Donnell, who I think does a really good job of playing Rosie O'Donnell, like, mm-hmm. as a thinly veiled version of herself. And I think of all the characters, she's the one that reads most explicitly as queer, both because it's Rosie and now we know Rosie was queer all along.
Exactly. And with that kind of character, she kind of always played with that anyway.
Right. And as she has remarked in interviews, that she, in her understanding of the character, obviously, you know, Doris is gay. Like, that's the thing. Like, she obviously was queer, because she has that moment on the bus when, you know, she's going on about how her boyfriend is, you know, dreadful, but she's with him just because he's the only one who could really accept her, a woman like her, as she puts it, I think. And then she ends up tearing the photo up and throwing it out the window. And mm-hmm. I was like, that's one of those moments where the movie just sort of is like, yep, these are a bunch of leses. Like,
yep.
Which is, I think, really interesting. And one of those moments where it's just, it really brings out explicitly what is largely implicit throughout the rest of the film. And then, of course, you know, we also have our own beloved America's Dad, Tom Hanks, who plays Jimmy Dugan, who's the coach for the team. who takes it on begrudgingly, to put it mildly.
Oh yeah, yeah. Because that is a very generous way of describing how
right.
he does this.
Because he's someone who has suffered from alcoholism and has basically lost his own career as a very successful baseball player, and so he's very resentful at having to take on this task. But his is the story arc that we also follow throughout the film as he, in traditional 90s sports fashion, realizes these women are extremely talented and he wants to actually genuinely help them succeed.
Mm-hmm. And also, just to tie this to what you said before about the husband character, the other thing that's sort of interesting about Jimmy is played by Tom Hanks is that, he's had to stop playing professional ball, because of his alcoholism, but because he's injured. Not just that he's struggling right. so much with alcohol, but he's actually also physically injured as a result of his alcoholism. So again, his body bears this mark of disability that sort of limits his capability in ways that he's not used to, that he has to adjust to, and that also stands out against all of these women mm-hmm. who are mm-hmm. able yes, to do the things that he can no longer do.
Right, that's a very good point. And it's very fascinating to me that it's Hanks of all people. Obviously, this is pre-America's Dad. So this is arguably one of the moments when his stardom is really taking off. Mm-hmm. And so it's also pre-Philadelphia, also, I think, very important to note. And it's just, because he always had that kind of boyishness. And, this is one of, I think, the few times where he plays, not a bad guy exactly, but kind of a bore. And I mean that B-O-O-R. He's very boorish and, rough around the edges. Even if you look at something what's that frat party movie he's in? It's not important. But, there's always something boyish and endearing, even when he's playing, scampy kind of characters. But this is really a unique role for him in some ways, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
And that's what makes it so interesting.
Yeah, because this guy, he's got a real mean streak to him.
He does, yeah. He's an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
That's the word I would use, is he's one of those people who's just genuinely an asshole.
Yes. One of the great sort of performance moments is, a bit later in the film when, this is of course after we've had the very famous "there's no crying in baseball" line that everybody knows right. from this movie, where, he's been chewing out the players and one starts crying, and that's when he delivers that line. When he's trying to correct the players later on and he's trying not to make that same mistake, so he's trying not to yell and to just offer up a more positively worded criticism. It's so funny because when Tom Hanks is doing this, it's like Jimmy is shaking from trying so hard to hold back the yelling and the anger. It's like he can mm-hmm. barely contain himself. It's like he just wants so badly just to scream at this person, but he doesn't. He manages to hold it in.
Right, and I mean, I bought the performance. That's what I was genuinely surprised, because there's just such a sharp juxtaposition between, on the one hand, Hanks' star text is this goody, baby-faced, all-American boy on the one hand, and then this asshole on the other. But of course, baseball players are themselves frequently positioned as being all-American, so I find that the role really works because of that unusual paradox.
Mm-hmm.
And then I do want to just speak briefly to Penny Marshall, who's the director of the film. Herself, a straight woman, but also I always thought there was something, for lack of a better word, lesbianic about Penny Marshall. And maybe it's her long friendship with Rosie O'Donnell. They used to be in Kmart commercials together. I don't know if you remember these.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it's just she also was, or maybe it's because she reminds me of my mom, who's also a bit lesbianic. I hope she never listens to this podcast. But there's something about her both in Laverne, as in Laverne and Shirley. I don't know, there's just something about Penny Marshall that always read to me as being non-traditionally feminine. Yes. And I think that that's what makes her a really good sort of directorial vision, a director for this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like I feel the same way about Penny Marshall. I always feel like she's always been so thoroughly her that I don't think of her sort of bound up in sort of traditional ideas about how to be any particular kind of person. She just kind of is herself.
Exactly. And I love that about her. I mean, and you see this because obviously like her brother, who appears in this movie as the sort of owner of the team, she is someone, who is, as you said, unapologetically herself and has appeared as an actress as well. She wasn't just mm-hmm. a director. And there is just something about her that is just – it's not glamorous. Like, she's not a glamorous actress, but she's just really damn good. And, I mean, mm-hmm. she's obviously very skilled as a director as well.
Yep.
And the last thing I want to talk about before we sort of do the dive into the queerness of the film is I do want to just talk briefly about, like, it's how peak 1990s, early 1990s in particular, this film is. Because there is something fundamentally optimistic. Like, the film doesn't, it has its drama moments and it has its moments of crisis and stuff. But there is throughout it, like, this particular kind of sensibility that is very obvious in a lot of 90s movies from this era of, you know, this is a golden age. Like, it's an age of optimism. Like, it's right before the Clinton years. And so, you know, I don't know. What do you think? Like, do you understand what I'm saying when I'm trying to articulate here?
Yeah, exactly. Ultimately, it has to end up being feel good, but not just sort of feel good in sort of a sloppy way, but in a really sort of uplifting kind of way.
Yes. Like, I think this is the, you know, one of the last periods in American cinema, I would argue, where we don't have the sort of brutal kind of bleak cynicism that has taken hold even by the late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Like, from roughly like 90 to say 95, you have, and this is purely subjective and I'd have to do some actual research, but as someone who grew, you know, was coming of age at that period and, you know, was was part of the demographic these films were intended for, it does seem to me, and I like that you say uplifting, because it's not the kind of, like, it is sentimental, but not in the way that we think about sentimental movies now. Like, this is one of those moments of real great success for directors like Spielberg, Ron Howard, obviously Penny Marshall, Gary Marshall. Like, there's a sense that the world is full of possibility, that things will be okay, that you can watch a movie and feel better about your life and about the country as a result of having seen it. That really does kind of go away by the late 90s.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I think there's a lot of obviously historical reasons why that's the case, but I think that's part of the reason I really enjoyed this film, which I've never seen it, oddly enough, which, you know, am I even gay, right?
Are you even gay?
Well, we'll get to that. But, you know, when we get to the end of the film, and, you know, Dottie having been persuaded to go to the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York, which I've visited several times, not the Hall of Fame, but Cooperstown, you know, we have this moment where all these ladies get back together, and maybe it's because I just love old ladies, maybe it's because I'm very susceptible to sentiment of this type, but I, you know, that was the part of the movie where I felt myself getting, like, emotional, which I think is intentional, especially when she reunites with Kit. Like, I just was like, oh my god, I'm gonna cry. And I think that that's very much a testament to its power as a 90s movie in particular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, it can explore some things, because throughout the movie there are, you know, quite a few unpleasant things about life that are brought up. It doesn't shy away from that stuff, but ultimately we have to end on a high note.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's not that there aren't still sentimental movies now, because God knows anything Steven Spielberg directs pretty much is drenched in sentiment. But because we live in such a much more cynical age, we read it differently. Like, most audiences going into A League of Their Own would not read it ironically, or it would not seem unusual to see a film of this type.
Mm-hmm.
And to embrace it for what it was. Like, I don't know that it would have occurred to many straight audiences, certainly, to read it, you know, with that slanted cynicism that we have now.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is the same age that produced Forrest Gump, after all. So, you know, I guess that's why I really enjoyed it, is that it kind of is nostalgic for me, because, you know, it's obviously made during my childhood, and there's something innocent about it. And I kind of wish that we hadn't lost that innocence, although, like I said, I understand why we have, but I kind of wish we hadn't.
Yeah.
All right, well, maybe that's a good segue, then, into talking about the queerness of this, because we did choose it for that reason as well. And obviously, as we've alluded to already, the cast is a big reason this movie has always been beloved by queer audiences.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that it's about female baseball players is a big part of it. So, you know, we're very well aware, and, you know, when I was prepping for the show, I wanted to make sure that I was right in my hunch, because I had thought that this film was, like, a queer classic, in the way that, you know, many queer classics are, that it's not actually about gay people and there are no real explicitly gay people in it. And I was correct. But I thought maybe what we could do is devote the rest of our conversation to sort of getting into that specifically, why it is appealing and what it can tell us today and 30 years later when it's a very different world.
Yeah. Yeah. And like we were saying, home audiences, TJ and I were saying before we started recording, one of the things that we think is so interesting, you know, about this movie as a sort of an iconic queer film is that it gives us so much to talk about in terms of things like gender performance rather than sexual orientation or sexual identity, because you've got this group, you know, of women athletes back in the 40s, that's going to bring up all kinds of questions about what it means to sort of perform life as a woman. And mm-hmm. The movie does a really great job of showing us that in a lot of its complexity.
Right. Yeah, because it's revealing, because one of the first shots that we get of Dottie and Kit is they're actually playing a game of baseball in their own sort of small town, which that I think is significant too, that, you know, these two women are coming from they're not big city girls. They're like basically farm girls. Like, cause they're, you know, we also see them milking cows, which maybe that's also why it called to me. Cause my grandfather was a dairy farmer. So, you know, we get this sense of that they're sort of the epitome of wholesome country American femininity, I guess is what I'm getting at.
Yeah,
they're the Rosen Islands, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny because as someone who didn't grow up with, you know, family members who were farmers and all that kind of stuff, I read it a little bit differently, but end up in a similar kind of place. Because so many of the women who make it onto these teams, as we see, are from small towns, you know, in rural areas and have that similar kind of background, which for me is not too surprising when we're thinking about this as, you know, 1940s era United States. You know, that's, I think, where you might have expected to see women sort of transgressing some of what we think of as sort of the norms of femininity because they have to do farm work. You know, it's like, and when you're on a farm, being a woman doesn't mean that you don't have to help out. You know, everybody has to pitch in and do the work.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I obviously the film is in its strictest sense, is a historical drama and that it takes place like during World War II. But it's really interesting that you brought that up in particular because, you know, to put on my academic historian hat for a while, you know, the war really did shake up gender as Americans had previously understood it before everything got sort of smashed into conformity in the post-war era. This is pre-suburb. I mean, not that there weren't suburbs, obviously, but this is pre-suburb domestic ideology America.
Exactly.
And you're right to point out that
this is sort of pre-sort of mass expansion of the suburbs because that was a post-war kind of thing. Right. We had all these folks coming home who were eligible to buy homes. Well, we needed homes for them to buy.
Exactly. And so you're right to point out that for country women, and this has been true trans-historically, that women who occupy lower rungs of the economic ladder often tend to have some form of greater freedom of gender expression just because you don't have the time to be traditionally, quote, like what we think of as sort of traditionally feminine. Like, you don't have time to just be a homemaker because, as you say, on the farm, you got to work. Like, as just one example, like, both my mother and my grandmother helped out on the farm as children and as young adults. Like, and as adults, for that matter. You know, you didn't have time to just, you know, be the happy homemaker. You had to do both in some cases. And so, you know, that's the kind of vision that we get of Dottie and Kit from right off the bat, is that there is a certain kind of, like, freedom that they have that women in the post-war world would not have had to such a degree.
Exactly. And we see that point particularly when we get the introduction of the character Marla. You know, who's another member of the league who plays on the team with our main characters. You know, when we meet her, she's another, you know, rural person that we meet. And she is presented very much if Kit is, you know, a tomboy, again, to use that old fashioned term. When we get to Marla, she's someone who's barely sort of recognized as a woman in the first place when we first see her. And, you know, right. Her story is that, you know, she was just raised by her father. She doesn't have a mom to sort of, you know, to teach her the ways of womanhood and all that kind of stuff. And so when she's presented, she's very much the stereotype of the unfeminine woman.
Right. And I mean, I have to say, I said this to you when we were watching the movie, but I always, like, I always feel sorry for the actresses who are cast, and the film makes a point of pointing out how quote unquote ugly they are. Like, it's like you must have a hell of a shell to be able to endure that kind of relentless onslaught.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, because that character Marlo, like, whereas again a character like Kit is just sort of presented like a fairly sort of average woman, you know, right, one who's going to be athletic and all that kind of stuff, whereas Marla is sort of singled out as the one who is not at all feminine. You know, they practically call her ugly to her face, and you know, they get right, almost that close to treating her that way. And so yeah, like when we were talking about that, and you were like, yeah, that's got to be tough for the actors. But you know, the thing is, actors know what they look like, you know. Right. You know, for all of our stereotypes about actors being sort of out of touch and all kinds of stuff, actors, they know who they are, they know what they look like, they know what they sound like, they know how they move, they know themselves in that way.
Right.
And right, also, and you'll notice that they also do things like they particularly style them to be extra unattractive.
Right, yes. And I mean, I give credit to Marla and the actress for being just so willing to hunch over, to have sort of faintly buggy eyes. Like, the film really plays with that extensively. And, you know, as you say, like, she thwarts gendered expectations in so many ways as a force of fun. And arguably, I think for a lot of, you know, gender non-conforming people, there is something almost like liberating about those kinds of figures, because they mm-hmm. do sort of trouble the waters of, you know, of the normative gender ideology that's sort of assumed to be quote-unquote normal.
Yeah, and what I love with Marla's character arc as she goes through the movie, what I love is that, you know, because we present her, you know, she's wearing, you know, basically men's clothes the first time we see her. And then as they go through, as they are on the team and they're kind of traveling around, you know, they go to these different towns where they kind of have to stay overnight. So they'll sometimes get dressed up and go out for a night on the town and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so we see her get dressed up. And so we get a bit of that makeover where, you know, she's cleaned up a bit, her hair is styled a bit more nicely, she's wearing a dress, a bit of makeup, all that kind of stuff. So we get that makeover where we then see her in a scene where she's like joined the band up on stage and is singing with yep. them, and she's really come out of her shell and is singing, you know, and doing practically stage fucking this guy who's watching her sing.
Yep.
Who is absolutely in love with her. Now,
yep.
what I love about the makeover is that it's not a complete makeover. Like, you know, she's, you know, still looks kind of frumpy when they do this, but, you know, she's wearing a dress and stuff like that. And she's singing and she's not doing a good job at all. It's not like she's doing this wonderfully sort of delicate but seductive song. No, it's coming off all wrong. The guys on the band, on the stage with her in the band, are like making faces like she's way off with the notes. Everything about it is terrible, but that guy in the audience absolutely is into her.
Okay, so to provide just a little bit of context for this performance that we're talking about here, you know, there's this moment when we have the women being basically sculpted into what the viewers, or the sort of the team owners, think would be the perfect icons of femininity. And it's so interesting that they juxtapose Marla, who, you know, needs all of this work, to Dottie, who is more traditionally feminine, even though, you know, she is the most skilled of all of them at the arts of baseball. So there's this really fascinating gender performance going on here, that Dottie is able to do both the traditional performance of what American audiences would expect of American womanhood, even while also transgressing by being so skilled at athletics.
Exactly. You know, she's presented in this sort of like idealized way where she sort of gets the balance, which is a nice way of subverting some of our expectations from the jump. Because again, this is the kind of thing where it'd be easy to kind of have the sort of traditionally feminine, traditionally pretty ones be the ones who aren't so great at sports. The ones who are actually better at sports are the ones who are a bit more butch, a bit tougher. Mm-hmm. But we don't do that. You know, we start out right from the jump messing with that set of expectations.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, obviously, as we've alluded to earlier, like, Kit is herself, you know, a bit more of a tomboy in that regard, even as she has this sometimes friendly but often, you know, forthrightly antagonistic competition or competitive relationship with her sister.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also what's interesting too is that when we look at all these different kinds of characters, we've mentioned May a little bit, the one played by Madonna, of course, but she's another great one to talk about, because she, like the real life actor who plays the part, is known for her. She loves to be involved with men. Mm-hmm. And so and that's a trait that May carries on her sleeve. And she's the one who actually most readily adopts the specific look that's proposed by the league when they're trying to brand these women and try to sell this idea of a women's baseball league to the public. You know, they decide to lean into showing off their feminine assets a bit more than most of the women are comfortable with, including Dottie. Mm-hmm. You know, even though she's very traditionally feminine and very pretty, she's actually pretty traditionally feminine in that she doesn't lean too much into her looks, that she's willing to give away too much in terms of sex appeal.
Right.
Whereas May is happy to go in that direction.
And May's particularly, like, you know, an interesting character. And I want to just make a brief footnote that I don't mean to keep using the word interesting so much. It's just the one I'm leaning on too much in this episode. But it's fascinating because she actually has a quasi, like, romance with Doris, which is Rosie O'Donnell's character. So there's a bit of ambiguous sexuality regarding that. Even as you rightly point out, she's the sort of voracious man-eater, like, you know, because there's that moment at the dance, which is where we see Marla do her crooning, and usually she has this rambunctious dance number with one of the other men who are nearby, and it's, yeah, obviously it's Madonna, so you have to see her dance, like, it just has to be part of that, and it's just a really fun play with, you know, Madonna's own sexuality and her own, you know, on screen particularly, like, bisexual aura, shall we say. And a show, you know, for example, it's something like Desperately Seeking Susan, which is more explicitly queer.
Exactly, exactly.
And so, you know, and it is fascinating in that sequence where we see, as you say, like, the league heads being like, you have to dress up in, you know, these fancy girly outfits, because they, not only to appeal to the masses by sexualizing them, but also, I would argue, to sort of defang the threat that these female athletes pose to gender normativity and to American masculinity in particular.
Exactly. And the way that that happens through this is so brilliantly done. I actually wrote a paper about this concept when I was years back when I was in college, that wrote about sort of clothing in women and the way that various fashion choices are designed to sort of constrain women's possibilities. Mm-hmm. So the uniform that these, you know, baseball players are wearing are these, you know, relatively short skirts. They're sort of like mini skirt type skirts to go with their uniforms, with their legs bare. Now, of course, they're playing baseball, you know, they, you know, which involves, you know, sliding into bases and all that kind of stuff. Men wear long pants,
right?
For that very reason, when we play baseball. But for these professional women playing baseball, they're supposed to do it with their bare skin exposed, from the lower part of their thigh down is exposed. And they don't actually get away from this because of a real life mishap that actually happened to one of the actors during the movie. Ended up getting bruised up during a scene, so we actually get to see that as a result of sliding around and things like that with your skin exposed, that tears your skin up pretty bad.
Oh, yeah.
And they actually show that happening.
Yeah, and it's one of those moments where the film is really taking aim both at the gender constraints of the 1940s, but even I would argue, and this just occurred to me, of the 90s. Like, this is the 90s, which is coming in the aftermath of, like, the backlash of the 80s, which was this reimposition, or this attempted reimposition, of gender normativity on women after the sort of women's movements of the 60s and 70s. So it seems to me that film is as much in conversation with its own era as it is pointing out the rampant sexism of the mid-40s.
Yeah, exactly, because we have that little bit of a debate that we get with, you know, the women who are sort of uncomfortable, you know, showing off their bodies in this way. Some women are offended by the idea of showing off their body in this way. They don't feel like they need to be sexualized. They think that that's unfair because they're athletes, damn it.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to that, it's supposed to just being sort of concerned about showing too much flesh because it violates their moral sensibilities.
Right.
There's the sort of ethical consideration that some of the women have, as opposed to just, I feel uncomfortable looking like a harlot.
Yes. And it's also,
and then, of course, there's May, who is comfortable with the dresses and will wear them.
Right, of course. You know, I mean, because you can't not be conscious that you're watching Madonna. Like, that's the thing. Like, anyone going to this movie knows who Madonna is. And it's also, that juxtaposes nicely with the scene where they first go out to the field and they're just enduring these relentless, not just catcalls, that would be almost expected, but they're just such rampant misogyny. And I think that some people will be like, well, that's just a little too on the nose. But in reality, like, if like me, you've read mid-century materials, that kind of, like, almost brutal dismissal of women was very much of the time. Like, that's, in many ways, the most realistic element of this whole movie is the absolute contempt with which many of the male spectators greet the spectacle of women performing in sports. Like, they just are like, go back to the kitchen and blah, blah, blah. I mean, women still face this kind of dismissal even today. Like, female athletes, that is, but also women in general.
And, you know, for me, I'm going to have to try to be a little bit more optimistic and say, but the movie also realistically shows even more characters starting off with a dismissive attitude toward these women players,
right,
but then actually seeing them, seeing that they're good, and then actually embracing them.
Right, exactly.
But, you know, because, of course, we're not, you know, we know society is never perfect. But what I like that the movie shows is that it shows that a lot of people were able to get behind this idea.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than doing the thing that I think would have been really anachronistic and just sort showing a whole lot of men being on the side of these women from the jump,
yep,
I think that would have been weird.
Right, exactly. But
showing that it wasn't that hard to convince a lot of men is actually fairly realistic.
Yes.
Once they saw them play, that was enough.
Yep, exactly. Because, you know, you do get the sense that these women were damn good. And they are. I mean, one of my professors from undergrad has chronicled them extensively. Cat Williams, look up her book. It's really good. And I think that it's, you know, the film is, you're right, it works dramatically, but it's also, like, realistic in the sense that, yes, it would take men a little bit of time, and just American audiences in general. And what I also appreciated, that it gestures toward the real challenge that the war posed to gender relations in the U.S. You know, I alluded to this earlier, but there is a moment, you know, when they're at one of the games, and the owner of the team is basically like, well, you know, we're basically going to win the war at another, you know, within the year, so let them have this fun and then we'll just send them back to their lives. And the other person in charge of the team is like, you can't do that. Like, these women, we basically encourage Rosie the Riveter types to get out of their homes and do this, and now you just want to send them back? And then the owner says, well, what do you expect the men to do? And so, obviously, that's historically accurate. That was the sort of crisis and the question on everyone's mind. But it also just points out the real difficulty of what you do when you give women this opportunity and then expect them to just go back to their lives the way they were before. And it just, it also cracks open this American myth of that women have always been satisfied with the housewife role. Like, I really appreciate that the film wears its feminism on its sleeve in that regard.
Yeah, exactly, because one thing that I do, that's a subtle thing, I think, but one thing that I really like about that debate about sort of what to do with these women now that we know that event, you know, fairly soon the men are going to be coming home. So the debate is between, you know, finishing the season and stopping, or letting them continue even after the men come back. It's not, let's just stop now.
Right.
Which it certainly could have been. It really could have been, well, the guys are going to be coming home any day now, let's just wrap this up. But it shows that even the men who were like, once the men are back, we don't really need the women to do this stuff anymore, didn't want to take away the opportunity to finish the season from these women.
Right.
And I was like, that's actually a nice starting point, I think, for a story like this.
Yes, I absolutely agree. And it's also, I mean, although obviously the women that we get to know in this film kind of finish up with the World Series that year, in which, you know, we get Dottie essentially throwing the game for Kit. Like, that's the gist and the implication. You know, the league did continue for several years after the post-war, which we get when the women reunite at the end, and they, you know, we see the league went on to, what, 52, I think? Or 54, something like that. And so, you know, it's a subtle allusion to, you know, that the war didn't just call an end to all of this stuff. And I think that is itself an oblique reference to the fact that despite the myth that would later grow up over the 50s as being this era of conformity where everyone sort of bought into domestic ideology, that there were always cracks and fissures and moments of resistance to that dominant hegemony.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, as I said, I mean, I can't not think of this film being in conversation with the retrenchment of that kind of domestic ideology throughout the 80s. Like, that, you know, coming out as it does in 92, it couldn't help but also be a part of, you know, this also moment when we're having women entering the public sphere in new ways, you know, in other kind of pop culture ways, like in Murphy Brown, for example, or other, you know, feminist texts that emerged during the same period.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like that. And it's also, you know, as we're closing in on our sort of conclusion here, I also think it's really interesting then that the film concludes with the women reuniting. And if, you know, after all these years of, you know, having been separated, most of whom have never seen each other again, but they recognize one another immediately. And as the closing credits...
After all those years.
Hmm?
So I was just going to say, yep, after all those years, they still recognize each other.
Yeah, exactly. And then, but as the credits play and we see them, like, you know, playing on the field and, you know, who are, if I'm not mistaken, are actually the real women involved with the league. And then Madonna's song is playing over, and it's a very sad and poignant and nostalgic song, referring back to this earlier moment, basically, with a sense of longing, which... I mean, obviously the film is itself very optimistic, and so that's what struck me, and as I've kind of thought about it in the days since, what really stands out to me is, you know, clearly these women are also, not mourning exactly, I think that might be a little too extreme, but there is a sense in which, you know, they've left something behind, and I think there is a sense of regret on some of their parts that, you know, that was a part of their lives that they were never quite able to recapture, and I have a feeling that, you know, that was a sentiment that they no doubt shared, or felt, I should say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think one thing that helps to contribute to that is just how much screen time is given.
Yes.
To this, because that's something that I didn't remember from having seen this movie, you know, years and years and years and years and years ago. I didn't remember that at the end, that we have that extended moment of once we're seeing these older ladies, you know, at this reunion where they're getting a chance to connect with one another and then play some ball again and all, you know, there's so much time spent on that it's like, it's almost like we become a different movie.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
At the end.
No, can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, it's like the movie A League of Their Own, you know, the period drama sort of ends, and we still have several minutes left set sort of in the modern day of these women, where it sort of turns into something that feels more documentary.
Right.
Where it's like these people who, because it's not obviously scripted activity after we have the moments, you know, culminating with Kit and Dottie talking to one another again and all that kind of stuff. And then once it sort of turns more just the sort of this playtime, it's more like sort of just unstructured playtime for these women athletes.
Right.
You know, as they continue to sort of enjoy themselves and continue talking to one another.
Yeah, I mean, I gotta say, like, that's, you know, aside from when Dottie and Kit reunite, like that, there was just something really... I mean, in less capable hands, it could have been schmaltz. Like, I could feel it putting its toe right on the line of schmaltzy, but it feels authentic. Like, there's an emotional authenticity that doesn't feel... It feels earned because we've watched the film, and so we really understand how invested these women were, because we, too, have been invested in them, in their lives, in their careers. So I think that's what gives that its emotional bite. And, like, I felt really moved just seeing these extraordinary women reuniting, but also, like I said, with Madonna's tones in the background reminding us that, you know, that was the sort of, I wouldn't say it was the apex of their life necessarily, but it was a, you know, there's a sense that it can't be regained, and I think that, yeah, that something has been lost, and I think that's a pretty powerful message, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for anybody who ever had, you know, the opportunity to do something like that when you were, you know, when you're a younger adult, or even before adult, that you get to do something that's really kind of cool, like play a sport you love at a professional level. You get those years of doing that, and then you'll go on, you'll live the rest of your life, and you'll enjoy what you do. You know, it might be great, but it's never going to be the same as that other thing.
Right. I mean, because it's very clear that many of these women have gone on to have great lives. Like, you know, some of them have passed away. Many of them have had families. Like, and even Dottie seems to have a conflicted feeling at first about, because she doesn't want to go to this reunion at all. It's only when her daughter asks her to go, like, basically strong arms her into going. But it's still clear that, you know, that camaraderie, they've never encountered quite the same thing ever again. And I think that, you know, maybe it's me as a Pisces and I live so much of my life in that frame of mind. Maybe that's why I felt it sort of calling to me so profoundly. But I do think that, you know, that's the power of memory. And there is something, you know, uniquely potent about the fact that this is the moment when they get memorialized at the Baseball Hall of Fame. Like, and we see them kind of being recognized by the premier institution of the sport itself. Something that they all struggled so much with when they were originally playing, you know, 40 years earlier. And so I appreciate the film giving us that at the end. Like, there's a lot of emotional registers that it manages to work through in those final, you know, what, 10 minutes that I think is a testament to how good, how damn good of a film it is. Like, it's not every film that could do such an, you know, an emotionally rich tapestry, but it really pulls it off.
Right.
And so just a couple other quick things that I wanted to mention. First of all, apparently Demi Moore was originally like Penny Marshall's, like, what, who she wanted to play Dottie, but she got pregnant. It would be a very interesting and different movie with Demi Moore, because Demi Moore similarly has a kind of bisexual affect in the same way that Gina Davis does, I think, I would argue. And certainly, you know, has shown that throughout her career. And there's also one of the most iconic moments in the whole movie is where a black woman throws the ball back to Dottie, who was actually played by a woman named Delisa Chin Tyler, who was actually a baseball player herself, which I thought was compelling for a couple of reasons. One of which is obviously that, you know, this film is a very white film, which is of a piece with the early 90s, and of course with the 40s too. In the sense that, like, obviously segregation was still very much a social force in the 40s. But it is a moment that's an allusion to a number of sports figures who are beyond the frame. And so there's this moment, like, of implied critique even of its own whiteness.
Exactly, because, like, we talked about how, you know, the TV show is, you know, a bit sort of unrealistic in its sort of depiction of diversity, but that's how we do things now. You know, back then, we have to remember that, you know, this movie is set before Major League Baseball was integrated.
Right.
So an all-white league is what we would expect to see based on that timing.
Yep.
But of course, the movie has to sort of acknowledge that. So it gets that little moment where we get that scene that sort of subtly acknowledges that race problem.
Right. And I mean, I actually misspoke. She's a softball player, not a baseball player, but still.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I just needed to, which there's a whole conversation to be had about the whole designation of softball. Like, that's a whole sports conversation that I'm not prepared to have, mostly because I don't know that much about sports.
It's a totally different sport.
Right. But anyway, I digress. But I do enjoy that.
I'm exaggerating so much when I say it.
But I will say that, you know, I didn't really know what to expect with A League of Their Own going in. I just knew that I wanted to do it because obviously it's in the conversation because of the new one, but also because I'd never seen it before and it felt like something I should see. But, you know, as a result of this conversation, I feel like I personally have a much richer understanding of just how transgressive it is and how deeply thoughtful it is. That's the thing I think that surprised me. And I think it's one of the values of doing these kinds of deep dive intellectual conversations about mainstream movies like this, is that they really help us to see how, even in an age, you know, that was relatively stable in the U.S., there are still these films like A League of Their Own that show, you know, how transgression was taking place, even if it wasn't always explicit or as obvious as we might want it to be today. And so, like I said, I got a lot out of this conversation, which I did not expect. And, you know, to some degree, I didn't know what we were going to, how this was going to take shape. But I don't know about you, but I was really excited the things that we talked about.
Yeah, exactly. The movie gives us such great things to explore, so.
Yeah. And I mean, like I said, it's still very relevant. And I think that there's still a lot more to be said about A League of Their Own. All right, well, that finishes up our main discussion. So give us just a moment and we'll be right back. All right, well, welcome back, everyone. So this week, we're going to both do a deep cut, which we haven't done in a few weeks. Now, I had not seen this film before, so I'll go first, and then I'll toss it off to Aaron, if you'll forgive the sports metaphor. So I had not seen this before, but I did as I was watching it, and I've alluded to this a little bit in the discussion, but my mom is not a baseball player. She doesn't like sports, but she is someone very much from the same milieu as Dottie and Kit, in that she grew up on a farm, was a tomboy, you know, would kick the ass of any man who tried to, like, do anything to her, or, you know, made fun of her in high school, grade school, doesn't matter. My mom is a kick-ass woman, and is still very gender non-conforming, like, you know, can swear like a sailor, like, is not, you know, eschews most of the trappings of femininity as you would normally expect it, always worked outside of the home while I was growing up, has short hair, you know, is kind of butch, I think it's pretty safe to say, what you say, Aaron?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's also someone deeply attached to her womanhood. And I think that that's a really fascinating seeming contradiction. But I think one of the things that A League of Their Own helped me appreciate through characters like Dottie is that, you know, that's not as much of a contradiction as it might seem to certain kinds of people like me. And I think that part of the reason that I felt so emotionally attached to this film is because it kind of gave me a renewed and, I think, more nuanced appreciation of my mother's gender performance and the way that she kind of, like Dottie, epitomizes that contradiction and doesn't worry about resolving it necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's something that even I, you know, progressive queer person that I am, sometimes kind of have to struggle to wrap my head around, even as I, like so many of us, are full of contradictions. And so I think what this film has done for me is to give me a new way of looking at that, and I think that's something that I very much appreciate about it. And I wonder if, I think other people probably have a similar experience, and it's somewhat true for my grandmother, who was more traditionally feminine than my mom, but was also a farm girl, you know, and who would have been of the age of Dottie and these other characters. And so I think that's one of the great things about both of my parents and my grandparents, is that they didn't model traditional gender norms for me and didn't feel like they needed to. And so I think that that's one of the great things I appreciate about them, is that they gave me the freedom to sort of explore my gender and sexual performance in a way that I don't think other people maybe in my own upbringing would have. And so I think A League of Their Own has really made me appreciate that a lot more.
Nice. Nice.
And so what's your deep cut?
Nice. And so mine's going to be very, very, very different. Mine is going to be, okay, because as a kid, I was not the most athletic child to ever run around on a playground. I was terrible at pretty much every sport, but I played them all. But that's not actually what I want to talk about, even though I did play baseball as a little kid. I actually want to talk about the scene where they all go out to that dance hall where with the scene where Marla sings and there's all the dancing going on. Because I want to talk about how this sort of influenced me as a young dancer.
Oh, okay.
Because this movie came out before I started dancing. I didn't start dancing as a young kid like a lot of folks did. I was actually 16 when I started dancing. So that was, you know, after this movie came out. But seeing this scene is one of the things that first got me interested in what became the craze of swing dancing in the 90s. Because that wonderful scene of showing these folks just moving around and having so much fun, that was something that, you know, as a younger kid, I actually wasn't exposed to very much dance. So the idea of seeing these people just sort of moving their bodies and having so much fun was really eye-opening for me. It's one of the things that I looked back to when I finally did start dancing, when I was like, you know, why did I decide to do this? That scene is one of the things that comes to mind, because it was one of my earlier moments of seeing what people could do physically, like with our bodies, to the music, to express ourselves in that way.
Oh, okay. That's, I mean, so this film specifically.
Mm-hmm. And also, for not just the swing aspect of it, because, of course, if we all remember the swing dance era, it was all over the place. So you couldn't mm-hmm. get away from it. But also, in particular, Madonna, like outside right. of, you know, swing dancing. Madonna was a dancer, actually, before she became a professional singer. And she was a dancer with my favorite modern dance troupe, Alvin Ailey's American Dance Theater, when she first moved to New York. And so, again, when I became a dancer and started learning more and more of this stuff, I remember going back to find this again, to find, you know, Madonna, to get an example of her dancing like she did early in her career as an entertainer.
Hmm. Well, that's real. I mean, I have to say that's genuinely fascinating. Like, I did not know that about you. Mm-hmm. So, and I will say that, you know, that's what I love about these deep cut moments, is that even films that, like, you know, I haven't seen before, or in your case, you have seen before, like, they open up so many different, like, emotional resonances. And I personally, as a, you know, as both a scholar, but also someone who thinks a lot about feelings and the way that movies and other screen texts, like, evoke these emotions in us, I really think that's one of the values of revisiting films sometimes, especially older films, is that they really do sort of help us grasp how much of a really big role popular culture plays in our development of our subjectivities. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think that's something that goes under thought sometimes, but I, you know, that's why I think that deep cuts is such a valuable segment that we don't always do, but when we do it, I do think that it helps us realize just how pivotal films like A League of Their Own are to our development as queer people and just as people in general.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And that point you were just making about, we don't always think about pop culture influencing us in this way, but we really should, because that's what we spend so much of our time engaging with.
Right.
You know, for every sort of, you know, highbrow, highfalutin thing that's supposed to enlighten me, I spend way more time with pop culture stuff. That's the stuff, right, that really sort of sinks into our psyches.
Yep, exactly. And I think that, as you said, I like that expression, sinks into our psyche. Because I do think that, you know, for so many of us, particularly, like, any of us born in the age of, like, mass media, which is to say all of us at this point, it's, you know, it is pivotal to how we make sense of the world and ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, give us one more moment, and we'll be right back to give you our social media channels. All right, well, thank you, everyone, for joining us for what I like to think of as yet another great episode of Queens of the Bees. I think that we get into some really fascinating material here, and I do hope that we will, at some point in the future, do a episode of the new League of Their Own and put it in conversation with this, because I do think that they are very much of a piece. So, I'm not even going to bother asking Aaron about his social media channels, because I know he doesn't have them, and I don't want to harass
him. Wait, what is this social media thing you're talking about?
I tell you, ladies, gents, and envies, I do not know what to do with this guy sometimes. I do not understand it. But anyway, he also said something very mean about my thirst traps on Twitter, so I need all of you to like my thirst traps on Twitter just to show him.
I didn't say anything mean about your thirst traps.
Yeah, I'm just kidding. Aaron is actually one of the nicest people you could ever, ever meet.
No, I mean, and let's not exaggerate now.
Don't let him fool you, kids. He is truly one of the best people I know. And I don't say that lightly.
No, I want everyone to think I'm mean.
Anyway, I digress. So if you would like to follow us on our various social media channels for the moment, until we get sort of devoted ones of our own, you can follow me, TJ, on Instagram at TJ West in the number 3. Or sorry, Thomas West in the number 3. You can follow me on Twitter at TJ West in the number 3. And you can also check out my Substack newsletter, Omnivorous, where I do write frequently about all sorts of gay stuff over there. And I really would appreciate it if you'd read it, and if you could subscribe, because I, you know, subscriptions are how we indie writers thrive. Or don't, as the case may be. And of course, if you have a few moments of your precious time, we really would appreciate it if you would either rate us or rank us wherever you listen to your podcast, particularly on Apple, because the more ratings and reviews we get, the more easily we are discovered by others. And for a little podcast like ours, that is still the little engine that could and still trying to get that breakthrough that we're all so desperately crave, we need you, our devoted listeners, and I know you're out there, to rate us. And of course, if you'd like to leave some critical commentary, you can forward that to Aaron. And if you would like to format nice complimentary things, I'll be happy to read them. So please, we leave those, though. We do truly appreciate them, and we do read them. So, for this week's episode of the Queens of the Bees, I am TJ.
And I'm Aaron.
And we will talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.